Welcome to Work in Progress. This is Sim.
This is Ko.
And we are so excited today that we have an amazing, amazing guest with us, Mrs. Renuka Kriplani. She is the current host and editor of Autocar Show on Times Network and is the executive editor for video content for Autocar India. As part of her job, she test drives and reviews cars for the Indian market. She's a true trailblazer in the autocar industry. So we are so excited to have you on.
I'm really excited to be here as well and always happy to chat on something that is a passionate subject of mine.
We've probably had the longest bio for any episode and there are a few more things that we wanted to add. Obviously, there are a lot of achievements and, you know, we're going to get into all of them. But just to give our guests a little bit of a preview, there's a lot of rallies that you've, you know, orchestrated across the country and globally. You've worked with the government. You've also been a juror on many awards like the World Car Award, the Women World Car of the Year, which we really are excited to know more about. Engine of the Year, Interior of the Year. You've also been a partner in Road Tripper, which is a company that, you know, you gave birth to because of your passion. And I think the coolest thing was recently you set the world record for becoming the fastest woman in the world to have a speed of 357.10 at the Pininfarina Battista.
With the Pininfarina Battista at Natrax. But I have to correct you there a bit. It's not the fastest woman in the world. There are a lot of women that are faster, but this was the fastest in a production car.
Right.
Okay. So,
right.
Yeah. So, you know, when there are women who've done 900 kilometers an hour, believe it or not, but those are in purpose-built cars, right, that's done on the salt flats in Utah, and they're just built to break records and speeds.
Oh.
But this is a production car that anybody can drive.
Yeah.
And so that was the fun part of doing it. And it was at Natrax in India,
right,
which is a government-built facility, something that I think I'm really proud of in our country because, you know, when you think of India, you think of roads, you don't really always think of the best. And this mm-hmm. government facility is, I think, one of the best test facilities I've been to across the world. And I think even the Italians that came in with the Pininfarina Battista were so surprised by it, they continued to set a few records extra by themselves as well.
And the fact that Mahindra is also associated, right?
Absolutely. So it's a company that's owned by Mahindra. So it's technically a Mahindra car we broke the record in.
Yeah, which is fantastic. Yeah.
And it was really seeing these things online and when we came across it, it was honestly really inspiring. And like you said, it's an Indian facility that we broke the record in, you broke the record in. So that was also really nice to see. We were seeing in your Instagram bio and places that you have spoken at, and something you use to describe yourself is driven.
Yeah.
So we wanted to know, what is it about cars that you love so much and where did this passion start?
I think this passion probably started because my dad used to build and race cars. He tuned cars. He restored vintage cars. And very often after school, I would be picked up and taken to the garage because mom was busy at work. So dad had to pick me up and take me. And then I used to wait at the garage till I was picked up. And then, you know, when you're a kid, they just give you something to occupy you.
Yeah.
So I would often be given car parts, open this, close that, do this, fit, you know, so I kind of grew up around it, fidgeted with things, saw the mechanics at work, saw my dad at work, saw cars being built. And it always fascinated me. And I think I grew up with that bent of mind that, you know, opening out things and finding out how they work.
Yeah.
So that's been a part of me always. Like at home, I remember my mom used to get hysterical because if the radio broke down, I'd open it out to fix it and stuff like that.
Wow.
I wasn't a pro at first. And soon I learned to get better at it and actually fix things. Initially, I was just opening them all out. But yeah, so that bent of mind of just learning about things and cars was always a passion. My dad was always pointing out cars to me. He got new cars home. So that was kind of where it began.
Yeah.
And as I grew up, I think a lot of people have heard this story and you guys have probably seen it and read it. It wasn't really what my parents wanted me to do. So tried my hand at a lot of different things. But, you know, when you have a passion, you have a passion.
Yeah.
It just doesn't change. As you go round and round in circles, you come right back to it.
But I was mind blown when I read that, you know, you went to do your MBA, you started your own business, right, with interiors, and then you came back and then you bought the car and then you went for the race, like at that age, it's incredible.
Yeah, so I didn't do the MBA, I did my commerce at HR college, which is when I realized that there was never going to be the MBA in my life because it's not something I enjoy doing. I'm not a desk person. I think regardless of what I would have done in life, it would have been something that has constant change. And yeah. I think that's one of the things I love about this job is that no 2 days are the same. You know, it's always different. I'm trying something new, testing something new, going to a different place. And I think that's what keeps me motivated even today.
Yeah,
no, for sure. And also we were reading and I think we were hearing your last talk. And one thing that really like kept us going and was really fascinating to hear was your first racing car experience. So I would love for you to talk about that a bit more.
Okay, so it was kind of going against my dad's grain, I think, as you guys have read. So he didn't really want me to rally and race. I have no clue why, because he did it all his life and I grew up watching him. But it wasn't something that he was like, okay, hey, you know, like I'd be proud if any one of my kids wanted to do it today. And unfortunately, none of them want to. But I don't know, maybe he had his own perspective or thought it was not so safe or there wasn't really space for it. And it's an expensive sport, to be honest. So he wasn't really keen on it. And I remember all the boys that I grew up with around the racetrack when I bought this car off my dad. So my dad used to, you know, at the end of the season, they would always sell off their race cars. And by then I had enough money to buy a car I could drive. So I thought, what better car to own than a race car, you know? So I bought it. I mean, it was nothing fancy. It was a Fiat that was just done up, tuned really well. And I used to love being at the signal with this very unobtrusive looking Fiat and then just take off in it where, you know, everybody looking around. But I started off buying the car and all the boys that I kind of grew up with around the racetrack were like, come on now, you have the race car. You got to do something with it. So they kind of convinced me to enter that first race in Juhu. And I was like, I don't have the first about racing. I've never been on a track. I mean, how am I going to do this? And they said, just do it. Yeah. So that's how it really happened. And by then I was already like kind of, you know, meeting up with these friends at events and we'd done some go-kart events and stuff like that together. So Farah Vakil, who was another girl who was racing at that point of time, had met her at a go-kart event. She'd become very good friends and we decided to rally together, but I was going to navigate for her.
Okay.
So when I bought this race car, she was also there at the race. Of course, everybody supporting me full time. And the boys really prepared me for it, I have to say. One of them even went and borrowed tires from my dad because my dad wasn't giving me anything. If you want to do this on your own. And he went and borrowed tires from my dad because he looked at my tires and said, are you going to race on these? And I hadn't a clue as to why they weren't correct at that point of time. And he told me, no, you need proper new tires that are going to get scrubbed. And he went and got the tires from my dad, put them on my car. And then he told me, you better just win because now I borrowed these from your dad. If you lose, I've got to return a set of tires. And they kind of helped me along, prepped me. And there was the qualifying. So I went out, I did the qualifying. And at that time, I wasn't really nervous because I said, okay, now I'll just go out and have fun.
Yeah.
And then I qualified second on the grid. And that's when I started getting really nervous. Now, one would imagine it'd be the reverse, that you'd get confidence. But then I got really nervous. Because then I said, shit, now I have something to prove. Now I've got to do well. You know, like now I've come so far, I can't be second on the grid and then come last.
Yeah.
This is not going to work.
Yeah. You've already
set the bar. So that whole night, I was like, you know, the nerves were getting to me. And next morning, my legs were shaking on that accelerator, I remember. The boys at my window and I'm telling them my legs not stopping to shake. What do I do? What do I do? He said, just go out and drive. And one of them told me, if anything's bothering you, turn the rear view mirror. So I said, that's exactly what happened because when we started off the race, we kind of, the two of us, first and second, were neck to neck. The guy third behind us was coming to overtake and I think he just braked too hard and the car rolled.
Ooh.
And I saw that in my rear view, got sight. And then I said, okay, I'm going to listen to the advice, turn that rear view mirror. And then I just drove like a bat out of hell. And very soon, so I'm saying this in the exact order that it happened for me. Yeah? So very soon I just saw yellow flags being waved all over. And when yellow flags get waved at you on a track, you just slow down or stop. And then the marshal literally came halfway across the track to stop me. And he's like, ma'am, the race is over. Why are you going round and round? And I'm like, oh, bloody hell. You know, I thought I'd done something really, really wrong. Yeah. And I was wondering what had happened, that the race had got over. I hadn't noticed. I thought maybe they stopped cars and I haven't noticed. I still didn't realize race is over meant the checkered flag had gone down because I hadn't seen it.
Right. You were in the zone.
I was in that zone of driving. And I came off the track in those days in the Juhu circuit. The stands were right there where you came off the track. I remember taking off my helmet because Farah was pulling me out of the car and she's shaking me and she's saying, do you know what you just did? And I'm like, taking off my helmet, I can hear this in the stands. Oh, la, ye to ladki hai. And you know, then your heart sinks like, oh, what have I done? What have I done?
Yeah.
And then Farah saying, you won, you idiot, you won. Why are you going round and round the track? It's like, okay, then it sank in, you know. So it was kind of a goose flesh moment. I still get goose flesh when I say it because that's when I realized that I'd won the race and I was just so in the zone that I hadn't even realized I'd overtaken the car, gone ahead of him, driven, checkered flag had come down. I was just still driving and enjoying that experience.
And this was with 18 other boys, right?
Yes. Which there was a feel of 18 men.
Yes, men.
Because I was a girl at that point of time. So it was really, really thrilling at that point of time. And I think my dad was proud. Nazir Hussain, who used to organize the rallies and was originally my dad's partner and someone who had seen me grow up, I remember him coming and giving me one of the most massive hugs and being so, and you know, it was just a great feeling to know that, okay, I went out and did what I really wanted to do and I can do it well. And then started the roller coaster ride of doing well and not so well. And then you know, the
ups and downs
of life. Yeah. But I guess that's what makes you go on, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. For sure. I mean, I think also once you've had that experience, you probably crave it more and more.
So there's someone asked me just yesterday, we were out on a drive and Rian asked me, said, do you miss your rallying days? And I said, strangely, at this stage of my life, no. I'm glad I had those days. I'm glad I had all the fun I had. I relive it with fabulous memories. But if you had to ask me today, would I want to go out and do that? Not really. I'm done with it. You know, I've had that fun. I've had that excitement. I still enjoy driving fast cars. I still enjoy breaking records. But no, I don't feel the need to go out and enter a rally or a race else. Again, I'm sure if there's a race between like journalists or something, I'll go out and do it and have fun. But it's not something that I'm driven to do anymore.
Yeah. No. Also, you said that once you won the race, something you heard was, hai, ye toh ladki hai. And I feel like that's something for women all over India when they're driving even their normal cars, that's something that they face and hear all the time. Do you think that's changed? And what has your experience been with that through your journey and your career?
So like I told you, I used to enjoy standing at the signal. And mostly because I was a girl and the guys that saw me get ahead of them were like, you know, anybody would race just to try and match
just
you.
Just to prove a point.
Goal and can't happen. And that used to be the way it was. I think it's changed quite a lot because in those days, not so many women drove cars as well.
Mm-hmm.
But I see that's hugely changed. You see women on scooters, bikes, cars, absolutely. You know, everybody's driving these days. And I think that's changed. And I'm glad that mindset has changed. I once gave a talk for the Femina Miss India.
Yeah.
Because they had a go-karting round and, you know, I was asked to speak to all the women. And I even then I said, and even today I say at any women's function, be it in the field of motorsport, driving, wherever, it's a mindset that I think we women have in our minds. I don't think it's more external anymore. I think women are conditioned to think that women are bad drivers. You know what I mean? I don't think women are bad drivers. I think they're safer drivers. I think they're far more careful because of this conditioning.
Yeah.
And probably have less accidents if there are statistics. And there have been a lot of studies on this that have proven that women are safer drivers.
Yeah.
But honestly, I think we need to get rid of that mindset in our own minds. I think we need to get rid of that conditioning and on many, many levels. A lot of the times when I'm asked to speak at women's functions, I think I'm the sort of person that they want to chuck out of the room because I'm not that women's liber kind. I think what you feel and what you have within you will reflect outside. And I think if you have the confidence, if you believe in yourself, it just doesn't matter whether you're male or female.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter who you are, what your personality is, what your gender is, what your pronoun is.
Yeah.
It really makes no difference, because you've got to believe in yourself over and above everything else. And if that belief shakes, that's when the external things start to affect you.
And start, the chatter will get to you.
Exactly.
Fair enough.
I was reading, I think this must be an earlier interview of yours, where you said you hosted, I might be wrong, a rally or an event, and you, there was a Uber driver from Guwahati, and you had said that I would not expect her to drive the fastest, and she seemed like she had a meek exterior, but she just went for it. And I think those things are like
absolutely, and I feel so happy to have the opportunity to give these kind of women the opportunity to shine.
Yeah,
you know, she was so excited. She spoke basically only in the local lingo.
Right.
So she was very kind of reserved. And the lady who had helped us organize that event in Guwahati does some incredible work. She actually, her passion for driving got her to start training these women who really needed to make income for their households to drive Ubers.
Right.
And that's how she got them to stand on their own feet and become independent. And she thought it was a great fun day for her Uber drivers to come out and do this event. And I was really happy that they could.
Yeah.
And it was a part of that. And it was just so nice to see these people come out there, have fun, really be able to bash cars around and drive them to crazy.
Can.
And to know that they can. And they were so good at it.
Yeah.
So some of them, you know, that came were really, really good at it. It was quite incredible to see that happen amongst, you know, all the other people that were there.
Yeah, that's amazing. I think another thing we really, like, at least personally, are super inspired by was reading about the Women's World Car of the Year. So, I mean, I don't want to elaborate on it. I want to know from you.
So, Women's World Car of the Year is something that started many, many years ago by a woman called Sandy Mira in New Zealand. She kind of decided that all the juries in the world voting on cars had predominantly men. So why wasn't there, and there were so many women motoring journalists like herself, like me, even back then. We started with a group of, I think, six of us. And it was Women's World Car of the Year, and we were going to kind of build. And today, I think we have 50 plus jurors across the world on Women's World Car of the Year from all the countries across the world. So there are so many women motoring journalists. And I think initially people saw this as a Women's World Car of the Year. Oh, they're voting for cars that apply to women. No, we're women motoring journalists that are voting on a car that we think deserves a title of World Car of the Year. So it's not about a woman's car, but it's about a car that women motoring journalists are voting on. And it's a fantastic group of women. I mean, there's such an amazing amount of support in that group of women. And so many of them, I hear stories of. I recently wrote a piece on it for a women's journal. And I was asking them to talk. And I was surprised as to how many of them face a lot of, sexism, let's put it that way. Even in their own countries, which we assume to be advanced countries. Mm-hmm. And when a lot of people ask me that question, I always say, I'm so damn lucky. I've never really faced it in this country. My colleagues, my peers, people I work with today, people in the automotive industry, my co-journalists, co-jurors on others, I've never really faced this, you know, boys club and women kind of thing. On the contrary, I'm always one of the boys. But I think a lot of them do face this where, you know, they're just, because they're women, people don't take their opinions strongly enough, or people don't consider them. And that's sad. And I think sometimes it's, like I said, it's conditioning, it's whatever. But you've got to prove yourself. I think if you have the confidence that you're, again, I'm saying that if you feel you're right and you persist with it, I think eventually people see that confidence and people see that you're very sure of what you're saying. And that kind of comes out. So that's what we talk about a lot on that Women's World Car of the Year. We've done some great things. We started an International Women's Driving Day.
Yeah.
And it's getting recognized. So I think, it's just kind of promoting that, you know, hey, women drive just as well as men. Women enjoy cars just as much as men do sometimes. And some women enjoy it more than men do.
One of the things we were discussing before, you know, we just going over matter, what we could talk about. So I work in sort of branding, advertising. She works in PR, so similar. And we obviously, auto is one of the biggest spenders and, you know,
on
mass.
Advertisement.
Yeah. Exactly.
Stuff.
Like, and it really does shape a lot of perception. So over the years, like, a lot of the ads that you see, even specifically people they show in the ads, it's I'd say 90% men, but also like sturdiness and, you know, those kind
correct.
Of qualities.
Going up the very hill. Very male oriented.
But
that's
late,
changing
exactly.
a lot. Like, and that's one of the big things that Women's World Car of the Year has voiced
pushed for,
and
yeah.
pushed for. We've also instituted a Woman of Worth Award, which is for a woman from the automotive industry.
Right.
And
mm-hmm.
it may necessarily not be someone who's achieved, like maybe a CEO or a motorsport. It could be someone who's working behind the scenes as well.
Yeah.
So we're trying to do all of that and just get it more and more recognized. But
it
you're right.
Changing. Like, I mean, because, you know,
it's changing.
We did this study and it was, I think earlier it was just a man, then it became family car. And now it's almost, I think with EVs more so, it's positioned for women. Like, you wouldn't, the ad, I think it's a Maruti. Oh, no, it's Mahindra for their EV. They had it positioned as just women, which is amazing to see, because for the longest time, it's just been who's the decision maker, you know,
correct.
All these biases and stuff come in. And I think that's just, like, I feel so happy that it's come to, and it's not only that we are, like, we're at power with what's happening in
yeah.
the world, so to speak, like, in terms of portraying it. So, yeah.
I think sometimes, and I think this change is coming about because if you see, a lot of companies have now seen research where most car buying decisions are powered by a female at the end of the day.
Right.
So whether it's the man that decides he wants to go out and buy his sexy sports car and then isn't allowed to because his wife wants something more practical, or whether it's you know, the guy going out and buying an SUV because now he's got a family and, you know, the wife needs to take the kids to school. A lot of the decisions have a woman involved.
Mm-hmm.
So not targeting or advertising to the woman is a stupid thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, in India, car buying is a family decision.
Yeah.
It's very rarely a single person decision. It is a family decision. You take a lot of things into account. So I think that's what's changing when research has shown that, you know, you have to target a different kind of audience. Yeah, there is still the guys who want their car to be macho and male and very, you know, butch. And okay,
that's
it's fine
okay.
to have
yeah.
that identity. Yeah. But I think it's also great to break that identity.
And expand that
and
audience.
Expand. And I think Mahindra does it a lot. Like, we do a women's driving day program with them where, you know, we go out, we take the Thar and we get just women to come along.
Yeah.
In fact, when we did that, Ford did it with me. We had a women's advanced driver training program, which is where that woman had come in Guwahati. So a lot of the companies, and in fact, Ford was one of the companies when they were in India that used to constantly say, you know, we want inputs on what do women want in cars more. And that's one of the questions we asked all the participants that came, because it was kind of a research base for them as well. And I think more and more people are realizing that, you know, yeah, you shouldn't just target one segment of the audience.
It doesn't
the
make
audience is wider.
Sense
yes.
as well.
Yeah.
But I have a more technical question on design. Like, do you have, in terms of actual design and production of a car, do you think there's a difference in terms of who it's designed for?
And also,
you know, once,
just adding to that, there was a study, I think, that was done in 2019 that showed that the crash test dummies that are put in cars while they're getting approval, it's a standard white male-built crash
so
test.
Yeah. The Woman of Worth this year for the Women's World Car of the Year, incidentally, is the woman who invented the female crash test dummy.
Oh,
wow.
Okay. And that's why she won. So, the thing is, yes, design did play, like you said, the crash test dummy, the design did play for a very long time. I think it was very, because there were male designers, there were very few female designers. But I remember doing a behind the scenes sort of evaluation for a Korean company. And one of their designers was telling me that, do you know, he said, I'm going to show you pictures because this is a real secret. Nobody else knows. But we made one of the guys wear a sari and sit in the car. So because we wanted to see how easy it was to get in and out of the car in a sari, you know. Right. So they are thinking of it differently. They are viewing it differently because the car was being built and designed for India. Of course, the person was in a sari. But so people are looking at it very, very differently and now seeing the female aspect of the design as well and what women would like more. I just wish someone would find us a great place to put the handbag in a car.
Yeah.
It's like the nemesis, you know, like you're struggling between the boot and flying all over the car when you're driving like crazy. So
it needs to evolve beyond the coffee cup. And like,
No, but it was honestly when we were talking about the design aspect and something, it never struck me that a crash test dummy would be so important when thinking of whether a car is being designed for a woman as well. Or correct. Like there are differences.
Because it's a matter of size as well, yeah. Right? I mean, how your seatbelt sits on you, where it fits, how much it can protect you is all about
the
size, weight,
as well.
The way that, the person is shaped, etc. So I'm surprised that it took them so long to change
there.
That.
Yeah.
No, for sure.
We want to shift gears a bit and like, I'm really fascinated with all the adventures you had. Like, I think I've just obviously heard few, but I'm sure there's a lot. Obviously, I know that the border crossing was a very life-defining moment, but there's a lot. I think you said something in China, like obviously driving from India to Germany. Yeah. So just tell us some of the ones that have stood
Which stood out to you.
Oh gosh, there's so many great moments in life, you know. You reach a destination. And that's why I think driving is just the best way to see the world, you know. You miss so much when you fly to a place. Kind of driving there, I remember the first time I did it and I told someone, oh yeah, I've just driven back from Singapore. And they were like, what? Yeah, can you even drive back from Singapore? Isn't there an ocean in between? And I was, no, but
that was my question.
Yeah. And I was, but there, it's connected by road. And that's exactly why we got the chance to do it, because the governments, regional governments wanted to highlight that there's road connectivity between all our countries. And it was the most fascinating experience, you know, just being with a different bunch of people from different countries on the road for 30 days. You become like family. You kind of see the regional perspectives, how everybody is different. We're so similar in certain ways and yet we're so different, in so many ways. And it was absolutely fabulous. All the experiences I've had of the governmental events we've done, whether it's SAARC, whether it's ASEAN Rally, whether it's BCIM, and just meeting the different kind of people. I think, you know, just seeing different cultures and being on the road with people you've probably never met before in your life is a fantastic experience and something I think everyone should do once in a while, because it gets you to go out of your comfort zone. It gets you to do things you never thought you would. And it expands your mind, I think, in very, very different ways, because you're then sitting, you're talking to people, you're understanding different perspectives, views across the world. And it's quite fascinating. That's one of my standout moments. I think lots of fun events. I remember we had, during the ASEAN rally, we were running the second ASEAN rally, we were running the event, and they kind of called me Marshall because every morning I was kind of pushing everybody into place and getting everybody to do stuff and doing things. And we had, he's going to kill me for telling this story, but we had this, he's very, very senior in the police force now and with Interpol. But at that time, he was heading up a division in the Bhutanese government, which had got him involved in this rally. And we'd met kind of at events before, because we had to go for monthly things. So Karma and me kind of knew one another. And he was this very, he's built tough, very strong. And he had his team of four in check. And they used to come to me every morning and say, Marshall, please, if you start is at 6, he'll wake us up at 5 to give us a lecture. Yeah. Every morning he lectures us and this must be like this, that must be like that, in shape, you better be in the car on time. I don't want anybody from my team late. So Karma was known to be this taskmaster who's always perfect. And we, you know, how I'd met Karma was that we used to go out for smokes together during these events. And one day after fueling, I was passing by all the cars and hate litter. I cannot handle people who litter and chuck things out of their cars. If you own a car, you're educated enough to know that you shouldn't be throwing things out of your window. I've often gone, stopped, picked up things and thrown it back into people's cars. People can call me a mad Parsi. I don't care.
I love it.
But honestly, they need to learn. So I suddenly walk by and I see this, you know, like someone has dumped an ashtray onto the road. So without thinking, I just opened the door of the car that was with me. I was still looking down and I said, who the bloody hell did this? And I look into Karma's face and, you know, he's like the chief of police. And very quietly, Karma looks at me and he says, sorry, Marshall, I'll pick it up. And he just bent down and said, put it in the trash can. And the boys came out cracking up after that at the next scene. We just love this. From tomorrow morning, he's not going to push us anymore, you know, like. So there were fun moments like this that I remember and stand out to me. Just the meeting of people and minds across the world, that's been one of the highlights.
I have a question, like India specific, because you've been doing this for a while. Like, how have you seen the development sort of change? Do you think it's, you know, catapulted?
I think infrastructure is catapulting in a big way. I remember, you know, I've driven from Nepal into India very, very often. Mm-hmm. And about, I would say about 3 or 4 years before COVID, I had come back from Nepal into India and we were driving towards Delhi and I was expecting, you know, that you come into India and it's like literally shit show and you're driving. And that highway, Delhi-Lucknow highway, oh my gosh, every like 4 or 5 kilometers, there was a spanking clean loo, something which as a woman,
absolutely,
I really, really value, you know, when you're on
when
a
you're
road
driving,
trip.
Yeah. Those long distances.
And they were so well maintained. There was someone in there cleaning them all the time. The road was brilliant. And I have to say, you know, that Mr. Gadkari is really someone who's done a lot for the infrastructure in this country and he's on a charge. He's building roads like
and
crazy.
And I feel like it needs to be said.
That's because I think we live in cities where sometimes the infrastructure just unfortunately hasn't been maintained. Like Mumbai. I mean, honestly, this city should have better infrastructure. Yeah. Our roads forever and a day, even the newer ones that have been built, are just not built up to standard.
They build it today and there's a pothole
that
tomorrow.
That is exactly the point. And I don't think that it's not that they can't do it. You look at a road like Palm Beach Road in Vashi, it's brilliant. And it's been brilliant for the, I don't know how many years, it's stayed like that.
Yeah.
So they can do it. And I think, unfortunately, people don't realize the value of doing that enough.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, sometimes I think votes are got in the wrongest way possible as opposed to the right. Do the right thing, people vote for you any which way. So I think that maybe needs to change a bit and maybe we see those roads and we imagine the rest of the country to be like that. But honestly, I just drove in Gujarat, the roads are beautiful. Drive in Rajasthan, the roads are fantastic.
Yeah, no, like you said, like when we're driving across the city on a day-to-day basis and you're stuck in traffic and you're hitting every pothole possible, you're just like, I cannot do this for a long distance. But I feel like if you invest a lot now, maybe in the infrastructure of at least Bombay, it'll pay off for years to come. And I feel like you said, maybe that needs to be done sooner rather than later. Yeah. Also then, I think we touched upon it a little now that we're talking about differences driving in plains and mountains, but also differences in cars. We spoke about EVs and how there is this, concept for people that who drive cars that, EVs are not really cars. You want to hear the machine. You want to hear how the gears are changing.
I want to quote what you have written, which you've said, automotive enthusiasts like myself may scoff at soulless, soundless EVs, but there's no doubt that they are the future. So we were really interested to know.
So yes, when EVs first came, I think all of us as automotive journalists scoffed at them. I think we kind of said, I mean, it's all going to be the same, right? Electric motors just churning. There's no emotion in a car. But very recently, I was at an experience where I got to test back-to-back 4 or 5 EVs together. And I have to say, they are still differentiated. You can still do so much. After having driven some crazy fast EVs like the Pininfarina Battista, I can say they still evoke emotion. So I've had to change my words and take back a lot of what I said initially. I think they can evoke emotion. It's just that we have to get used to a different way of life and the different way that they evoke emotion in. EVs are going to be more about speed, the flat out speeds that they can achieve, and the way the cars handle. I think dynamics will become far more important because that will be a differentiator. Whereas in these cars, you know, the sound, the drama, changing gears, yeah. all of that was part of the experience, yeah. which I still thoroughly enjoy, let me tell you. For me, that will still remain it. But I think, yeah, it's, you know, how we evolve and how we got used to mobile phones now. We can't yeah. live without them. So, you know, who would have imagined that at the first, when they first came, everybody said distraction, this, that, who wants someone in your ear all the time? Now today we can't do without our phones. Everything's on them. It's gone to smartwatches, which I still think is completely crazy. I mean, like, the phone is enough of a distraction. Why would I want someone on my watch, that message pinging up like every 5 minutes?
Komal, you know, this way, at least obsessed with smartwatches.
But I have no notifications. It's just for tracking.
Yeah, but this way at least I can say I left it, my phone somewhere. I didn't have it with me. Yeah. Sorry, you know, yeah. but you can't get away from this. So it's how we get used to things, I think.
Why do you think EVs are being advertised so towards women? Like, they are really focusing it, I think, from whatever we have seen, towards, like, okay.
Because the men want that emotion. They want the drama. They want the sound. Yeah. So they're not buying this completely. So they need the women to convince the men, I think. No, but I think at the moment, while it's still nascent and it's the smaller end of the population that are still buying cars, I think that's where they're targeting it, because it can be the second car in a home, which is mm-hmm. used to run about in the city and stuff like that, which is why they, I think, are targeting women. Still buying it as a primary car, people are still worried with range
hesitant.
Anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Long distance travel, people are still worried about it, especially in our country. So I think probably that's why this is the target audience as a number. I think that's going to change.
Yeah, I feel like once the infrastructure also, like you said, for long distance traveling, there are yeah. those EV charging stations, yeah. etc. Maybe it'll become more popular with the remaining of the...
Yeah, but I'm not so convinced on this EV is the future. Because even if you see globally, they've rolled back, a lot of countries yeah. have rolled back their deadlines to say no more ICE, and they've kind of admitted that, okay, we'll have hybrids and we'll allow yeah. hybrids. Sure, there are different ways to reduce emissions, and I don't think only EV is the solution, especially in a country like ours where electricity isn't cleanly generated.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
So the whole argument about it becoming a cleaner
is, it's a very twisted
double-edged
argument.
Sword.
Yeah.
And it's not only at the source, it's what about the batteries? What about
exactly.
their disposal? So there's a lot of arguments in that need to be cleaned and that need to be sorted out. People are working on it, and yes, it's one of the ways to the future,
yeah.
but I don't think as advertised it's the only
yeah.
future.
Yeah. No, fair.
I think in the US especially, so again with work, we were doing a lot of research for Tata Motors, and you know, we had to, because it's so new, right? Like right now they have 90% market share. They know it's going to go down. And so we were reading, because I think US, there's a lot of conversation as usual about everything. They were very like doubling down on it in terms of state policy and stuff. And like you said, now they've taken it back. Understanding the entire ecosystem of it, like where are the batteries produced, where are they getting disposed. Also that hybrid sort of makes, you know, more sense, and the safety aspect as well, where luckily I think in India we've not had that many cases.
Yeah.
But I do feel the minute there's one, there's again going to be, because we're so risk averse as yeah. people.
And you see that in the two-wheelers, there's been a lot of the two-wheeler thing. So, you know, people will go with the safer brands and
yeah.
things like that. I think that there is going to be a rollback. I think globally, especially with this war, and you know, people have realized a lot of dependencies in
yeah.
certain focused regions of the world. COVID has, you know, also kind of made people realize that. So I think people have started thinking differently across the world with all the things, you know, all the geopolitical things that have happened across the world. It's kind of made single-minded, you know,
right.
vision open out to be a little bit more wider and more accepting of different kind of things. And I think I just think it's wrong to bank on any one thing ever.
Mm-hmm.
I would never put all my eggs into one basket.
Yeah.
I would always, you know,
diversity,
I would want
yeah.
to. And I think, why not? If you can come up with a better solution, who knows, it may be the better one, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, just because we have said that this is the future doesn't mean that
it has to be.
It has to be.
But, you know, the process for automotive development is so long and tedious. It's hard for companies to have their focus in very different directions. Yeah. It's expensive for them to
And
do
also
that.
Like do all the research and then take it back.
And that expense then comes back to the consumer, which then won't sell their product. So it's a chicken and egg story. It's difficult. What the automotive industry really, really needs to succeed is stability of policy wherever they are. Mm-hmm. You know, that's key for the automotive industry, because when things change and are so dynamic and they have to keep changing, it's tough on them.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot happening. I mean, there's a lot of subsidy from the government right now, right?
With taken away.
Exactly. So that's what even I was confused about, because initially it said that it was, you know, there was a big push. And so a lot of companies, I think like an Ola or like, you know, Ather, the newer ones, went doubly into production. And then some of it was also taken. So there's a lot of chaos.
And June, we've at Autocar Professional, we've just done an article on how in June you've seen that the taking away of the FAME subsidy has killed the sales of the two-wheeler market.
Killed.
So it's come down by half, I think. So it's, you can see the difference that it's making.
Yeah.
Also, now we are seeing Drive to Survive. I think there's a new
energy infused
in the youth of our country for like F1, and I know so many of our friends are so obsessed with it.
Me included.
It's garnered so much more female fan following 100% after Drive to Survive.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't follow, and I did see the show, and now I watch like all the, and that's with a lot of people, I think.
So it helps that there are so many cute looking.
Cute, 100%.
It goes without saying. Yeah. But, and also like our country specifically, I think we're like one of the largest viewers of F1 now after Drive.
So 100%. I think in the last 2 years, the amount of people and conversations, you go anywhere, it's about F1.
What were your thoughts on how it's again just catapulted?
I think the Americans are very smart marketing people. Yeah. And when they took over the F1 franchise, you knew that they were going to infuse a new wind into it. They've changed the way the racing is done. Maybe some of the old racing enthusiasts not entirely excited about it. But honestly, they've brought back the fan following.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
A very different fan following into the motorsport again. And I think that's what any sport is about. It's not only about the two people or the three people that are involved or the 20 people that are involved in that sport. It's about the fan following.
And
it's
the community.
The community that it generates. And that's why motorsport, really Indian motorsport, hasn't taken off, because it's never really had a massive fan following.
Yeah.
It's an expensive sport. It's looked at as being a rich person's sport. Mm-hmm. So it's not it's not cricket, which any boy can play in a gully, right? Mm. So it's tough. Cricket and football are much easier for anybody to catch
on
and play. So it becomes, then you want to watch.
Yeah.
Motorsport has always been tough. It's still tough to break into. And I think it's changing slowly.
Do you think like this whole F1 craze that has started is going to like more people to get into the
Mahindra
sport?
Mahindra is going to...
It does. And the two young boys, Arman and
Jehan,
have started the racing league. Yeah. I think that will help, because it kind of gets more people. It's access. You know, more people have access to getting into a car and driving and enjoying it. Then the community around them starts watching and enjoying it and stuff like that. Formula E came to India for the first time. So I think it's changing. It's nice to see motorsports finally, you know,
seeing the light
in this country. I think one of the toughest thing is to get sponsorship for motorsport.
Yeah.
I remember describing this as being a bhikari with a katori, you know. Wherever we went, it was like, please, they don't. Yeah. To whoever, like our friends, family, you know, like, please, we just want to do this one rally. We used to drive our cars down. We used to drive them back, because we just didn't have money to do anything else. And, you know, you literally had money for fuel to drive down, do the rally and come back. And then you couldn't even do extra testing and stuff like that. So that's changing. And it did change during our times as well, when JK and MRF came to motorsport. Mm-hmm. They really infused a lot of money, and it saw new talent emerge as well, even at that point of time. So there are, Volkswagen has done a lot for motorsport in the country. They've had a racing series. So it's changing a lot. A lot of it is changing.
Do you have a favorite driver or team?
Mercedes. Oh. A lot of it is because of Toto Wolff.
He is just, I don't even follow it that much, and when I see his face,
the
I'm
energy.
Just like,
yeah,
the energy is another power.
I just adore him. I've been a Lewis Hamilton fan for a very long time. A lot of people are not going to be very happy about that. I'm not a Verstappen fan. I just don't like him at all. I think he's arrogant. I think he's a baby when he can't win a race.
Are there any like Indian racers that we might not have heard about, but you would?
Jahan Daruwala.
I think
everybody's heard about him. Oh God, there are tons of really, really talented people. But motorsport is not, like I said again, not in our country looked at as a sport. Therefore, your parents, and I see a lot of girls tell me that my father won't even believe me. I want to do karting and I want to do racing. Because Lewis Hamilton's probably been in a kart since he was 4 or 5.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
So has Verstappen.
They know each other since.
So, you know, when you say the guy is talented, there's a lot. Yes, he's talented, and you do have to have that inherent driving talent. Because you can put, you know, someone else in his car and he won't do as well. And that's been seen. But even Naren Karthikeyan, phenomenal driver. Phenomenal, but just didn't have enough money to support his own career.
Mm-hmm.
It's because in our country, it's not seen as... And by the time he got the money to get into Formula One and stuff like that, you know, it's... You're outpaced sometimes by these drivers that have their entire life is doing
dedicated.
Just this. You know?
Absolutely, all of them right now on the track. It's like Charles and Max have raced together, like since they're 5 to 6 years.
And they're picked up by teams like Red Bull and Mercedes in their formative years and
so then
groomed.
They're growing with them.
You know, so it's a very, very different world. There is no grooming here. You kind of, you know, get into a car, you drive, you learn on your own. Yeah. There's like no, you know,
facilities
sort of or training or testing or anything. Yeah.
I think with people who don't know the sport a lot, there's always a conversation. Is it about the car or is it about the driver? So like, what do you...
Both. It takes... So you'd see it. I mean... First, everybody has a different driving style. So you have to realize it's about the driver being able to instruct the engineers on how he needs the car to be for his driving style. And that's a huge part of F1.
Mm-hmm.
I think someone who can do that successfully has been Max Verstappen, Lewis Hamilton.
Mm-hmm.
So, see, I'm not afraid to give credit, but I just still don't like the guy. But... You need to be able to know enough about the engineering, the mechanics of a car to be able to say, hey, I need this to understeer here, I need to oversteer, I need more balanced back, front, whatever, you know, I'm putting it in simpler terms, but there's a lot more that goes into this. And that's one of the things my dad insisted I do when I started racing and I actually started working with him. He would make me do the camber caster of the wheels and tires of the car with myself sitting with the mechanic so that I would understand how the car was behaving in every situation.
And understand how it feels when you're actually driving it.
Exactly. And I got so spoiled by that and I got into a race car. I remember once after driving my dad's race cars, I got into someone else's race car. At one point they said, hey, you want to drive my car for this race? And I spun out and smashed the car around the first corner because I was just so used to the handling of the other car.
Yeah.
And I came out of the straight and put my foot down and went completely off, you know?
Yeah.
So
that's why the
cars set up very differently for different people. So it's got a lot to do with the harmony between car and driver.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't give the credit to one or the other. Of course you need, I mean, you can be a Lewis Hamilton and still be at the back of the field because Mercedes ain't performing. But,
No, absolutely. Because like a lot of the drivers, when they come back, like they would say, oh, when the car's undergone changes, that I'm still getting to grips with it. It's not me or it's not the car, but like I need to understand how I can utilize it, you know, in the best
way. So when rules change and things change and you've got to get used to a different way. I mean, you know, when the cars became turbo from naturally aspirated engines, that was one big transition. Then they had DRS and they have, you know, energy boosts. And there's so many different things. I got a chance to drive the Formula E cars of Mahindra, which was also one of the most fantastic experiences I've had. And I got to actually drive Gen 1 and Gen 2 of the cars. And the difference between generation and... It was two different driving styles.
Wow.
Like in Gen 1, I literally had to stand on that brake and I was, you know, fighting with the steering. And it was a much harder car to drive. Yeah. And Gen 2 was a much easier car to drive. So it also changes. You have to adapt your driving style to the car. You have to change things. And, you know, when you're going at 300 kilometers an hour to keep adapting, it's not so... People just don't realize
what
the kind of focus, the kind of toll that it takes on your body, the kind of energy that you need. You know, everybody... I get so many mails, I can be an F1 driver. I want to, like, you come and sit... one round in that car, you
and
know?
Then see. Yeah, I mean, actually, it's like someone's even said, "Oh, it's how can you even say it's a sport? It's you know, it's all about like the machine." So I feel
you sit in that car.
Yeah,
I guarantee anybody. So we did this program with Michelin called Michelin Pilot Experience, and then they put you in a Formula 3 car, and it was great fun because we were a bunch of journalists. We were in that Formula 3 car, and at the end of it. Another female experience. there was a French instructor, and he came out and he said, "Who was in that last car behind me?" And I said, "Oh, what did I do?" So the guy said, "Oh, it was her." And he said, "Ah, woman, interesting." So he said, then he came up to me and he said, "You drove really, really well. I was surprised." He said, "I think we can take the limiter off your car in the afternoon." So I was kind of excited.
Yeah.
Full boost that I'm driving well and I'm, you know, you feel like a hero. And so we did all our rounds in the evening, drove flat out. And by then I was like feeling like the Queen of England that I've driven so well. Everybody's praising me and all. And then they put you in a two-seater car with one of their professional drivers.
Right.
And I realized what a duck I'd been driving. Like. You know, so it kind of takes all the wind out of your sails.
To
like,
see what
you,
it takes.
Damn, there was I thinking I'm going so fast. And, you know, when he went round the track, his braking point,
The
G-forces on my neck,
yeah.
Like my helmet was, because it was a twin-seater, my helmet was banging into his helmet every time he braked.
Right.
Because I couldn't hold my neck in place. And every time he turned, I was like this. And when I came back, I was like, oh God.
Yeah. Like I've seen videos of them training just their neck. And it's wild.
The amount of G-forces in a race car driver when you are driving at that kind of limit. And I think in the last season, you've seen a lot of the cars bobbing up and down like that. Yeah. And they tell you, okay, this one, you know, the aero on it is not great and it's not...
Poising.
Yeah. And it's porpoising, yeah. And when that happens in a car and for 70 laps, you're going, your body is taking that beating. You just cannot imagine how hard it is. So, yeah, it's very, very physical sport as well. Absolutely. Though it looks like someone's sitting in a car and sailing around a track, it's really not like that at all. And if you read about it, you read that the drivers lose so many kilos every single race.
Right, yes. I
race
think we've seen those
clips. Very hard
clip.
In the body. Yeah.
And like also, especially, like, there was one of Lewis and me talking about how he's started a race and by the time he's done, A, because of the sweat, and two, he was like, I've lost almost 4 kgs in
just those laps.
Yeah.
That's why.
Yeah, it is. It's very, very strenuous and you have to be physically fit. It's also... Like, I know, you know, like now if I get into a car after so many years and race, before I actually went to drive Formula E and before I went, you know, I was doing a race, I actually went back to my trainer and told him, like, I need to do arm exercises for, like, I don't know how many days because I need to hold that steering in place, you know. It
requires that.
That much dedication and work.
And if you don't have it, you go off the track because you very often can't do what
control
you need.
And then you'll put yourself in danger.
So my point is, it is a very physical sport as well. Yeah.
Yeah. And seeing all, we were just discussing before you came, Oni, that we see all these twists and turns in movies like Fast and Furious. How realistic do you think they are?
Oh, man. No, they are. A lot of them. Yeah. Oh, you have to see some people drive. Ken Block, you know, poor guy, but... If you've ever seen Ken Block videos, he was a guy that went viral and famous for doing this kind of crazy stuff with his cars.
Yeah.
So yeah, there are some amazingly talented people. And you know, when I see like Tokyo Drift and I very often I'm going up some theater in that, you know, and I'm thinking, oh God, how do those guys drift the car sideways up this whole thing and down this whole thing, you know? So yeah, I mean, you everybody's done donuts in their car at some point or the other. Yeah, when you have a nice open space to do it,
but doing it
in a controlled environment like that, again, F1 drivers when they're driving on a street race, you try it on a road.
Mm-hmm.
You'll see very often on an expressway when you come to the corner, the cars are veering from the left lane into the because people can't keep to their lane even at 80 kilometers.
Yeah.
Think about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. these guys at 300 kilometers have to stay within the confines of those two lines. Yeah. So my point is, when you drive like that, you have to have that intense, crazy amount of focus and control, because things are flying by you. And you do it as an exercise. Like, I've often told friends of mine, I said, stay within the two lines of that highway on a sharp bend.
And see if and you can.
You know, they start backing off. It's the same thing. Like, when we're driving, someone asked me, how was it to do the 357? I said, I think really easy, because I've learned to, you know, like, even when you're on banking, like, so you have the straight and then you have the banking. Most people, when they're on the banking, and that's what one of the guy, Italian guys that was with me, he's saying, you're so smooth with the steering. You're not moving it much, because people on the banking are trying to correct, because they're looking immediately ahead of them. And you're seeing the corner, so you're trying to control the corner.
Yeah.
We've learned as a race car driver, you look
right
way ahead.
So
you're aiming where you want to be, not looking at what's directly in front of you. And so you'll see them cut through corners straight and stuff, because you're aiming. You're not looking at this corner left and then that corner right. You're looking at straight where you want to be.
I never thought of that,
So it's a way of driving that you get used to as a race car driver. And it's always better to look ahead, isn't it?
I was just going to say, I feel like so many things you said, they could be, which are related to driving, they could be life lessons.
Yeah.
Like,
they are.
Don't focus on, like, you focus on your goal.
So many people ask me, what does this mean to you? I said, it's taught me so many things in life. Focus, you know, how to pick yourself up when you're down and just go on. Look ahead, you know, always look at the goal.
Yeah.
Stop worrying about the shit that's happening on the way.
Just
focus on the goal.
Yeah.
And there's so many things that you can learn from whatever it is that you're doing in life will teach you its own lessons. You just have to be attuned to listen to them. I spoke to a very interesting lady recently for one of the shows that we were doing, Sonam Kalra, Sufi singer. And she was also telling me the same thing. She's saying that people don't often just stop and listen to themselves, to the, you know, things that happen around them, and pick up.
Right.
We need to stop sometimes and just slow down and listen.
Yeah.
And be. And then you'll know so much more.
Yeah, exactly.
We usually always ask everybody this question, because the show is called Work in Progress. But I think you already covered it, but we'll still ask you. So how are you still a work in progress?
Well, I think this is the first time I'm sharing this very openly. So after 20 years, I've actually decided to quit my role as the editor of Autocar India and do things a little differently and change my tack once again. So, it's a scoop for you guys. I'm actually stepping down from that position at the end of July. I think it's just because I wanted to do things differently once again in my life. I still will be doing stuff auto. That is very, very much the passion. But I think the way media has changed.
Right.
It's evolved. I think I need to take a step back from what I'm doing, because I got so used to doing it in a particular way.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Not that that's wrong or right, but I just want to do it a different way. You know,
like your own way.
Exciting.
I'm not a spring chicken. I have these many years to go out and do whatever I want to do.
Yeah.
So, this is the time to tick off all those bucket list things and just enjoy life a bit and do it at a much easier pace, because this is very, very intense and I really don't even get time to think sometimes. So, just going to take two steps back for a bit and then redesign myself.
I love that.
Love that.
Yeah.
But thank you so much for coming. Honestly, this has been such a fun conversation for us, and we've learned so much on the way with your life lessons, plus with your journey and everything.
I think you're just a legend.
Legend.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been fun hanging out with you girls.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just...
And I'm going to be sharing F1 notes with you also.
Yes, please.
Although I can see you're a Max fan.
But see, you have to also understand, I would consider myself basic in this, like, because I joined very, like, I have no shame. A lot of people have shame saying that, oh, I started after after watching the series. I have started after watching the series, so I'm okay with that. And like, I also started when Max was on his rise. It's like with tennis, I started watching after Federer, you know. So I'm like Nadal. So I'm okay. I preface it with this. Yeah. But I have some friends who I can't wait to share these opinions with, because they're going to be like, oh my God.
Yeah. But thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. Yeah.
I hope you had fun.
I did. Yeah.
Yeah.
We are
done, girls.
Yes. Thank you so much.